Thanks for tuning in for the November 17th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's feature interview features a discussion on language, words, and neurology. For our other segment, you'll hear a discussion on apathy and impulse control disorders in patients with Parkinson's disease.
Hey, this is Jason Crowell with the Neurology Podcast, and it is my pleasure to welcome Martha Barnett back to the podcast. Martha is the co-host of a very popular radio show, Away with Words, which is a radio program on NPR affiliates about language examined through the lens of family, history, and culture. They also have a podcast by the same name, Away with Words, and Martha has written several books on the origin of words. This is the second time we've had Martha on the Neurology Podcast. Ted Burns interviewed her back in 2007. So Martha, it's been a few years, but welcome back to the Neurology Podcast.
Thank you so much, Jason. It's good to be here again.
So I have a couple of questions for you today about language and grammar that I think are relevant for us as neurologists, though I'm sure some of these rules apply to many other scenarios in our lives. And I guess we'll just go ahead and jump right in. So my first question for you, and I've got several scenarios that I'm going to use to paint these pictures. So when I'm in clinic and I examine a patient, I perform an exam to assess the patient's nervous system. When I do that, do I perform a neurologic examination or a neurological examination?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I would say from the position of a layperson that you perform a neurological examination. And that's because for those of us who aren't dealing with this every single day, neurologic sounds like happy birthday to, and then you're waiting for the next syllable, you know? But again, when I was talking about language 10 years ago, I was a lot more prescriptive than I am now. And, you know, it may be that in your workplace, everybody says neurologic. And especially if your boss says neurologic, I would go with neurologic. But it's a little bit squishier than you might think.
So it sounds like I should use the rule of thumb of what sounds best. So let me ask a follow-up to that then, if the rule applies here. So if I have a patient with weakness in the right arm and the left arm, would I say the patient has symmetric weakness or symmetrical weakness?
Again, the more common term would be symmetrical. Symmetric is what we in the language business call a needless variant, sort of like a preventative is just a little much. You don't need that extra syllable. Preventive works just fine.
All right. Next question here, an article adjective question for you. Suppose I need to use an abbreviation, and when I pronounce the abbreviation, it begins with a vowel sound, even if the first letter of the abbreviation is a consonant. So for example, a mutation in the superoxide dismutase gene can cause familial ALS. So that would be an SOD mutation. So would I say the patient has an SOD mutation or a SOD mutation?
Yeah, you would definitely, in this case, say the patient has an SOD mutation, unless you're going to pronounce the name of that mutation as SOD. What you have there, actually, when you think about the sound of it, is three different sounds, S-O-D. And if you spell out the way that those letters sound, actually, the letter S starts off with a vowel sound. It actually starts off like E-S-S, S. And so you would want to say an SOD mutation.
Got it. Very good. Next question, switching gears a little bit. When I present the history of a 55-year-old patient, do I refer to him as a 55-year-old man or a 55-year-old male? I guess my question here is, can man be used interchangeably with male?
In your particular workplace, right? In your particular field. Because, of course, sex and gender aren't synonyms. You know, sex refers to the biological differences between males and females, and gender refers to something much more complex. And what if, for example, your patient is transgender? What if that person is intersex? You know, I think focusing in too much on one single word can trip you up. And either way, you're going to have to go back and explain in more detail anyway. And again, this is a place where the language is somewhat in transition, and it's going to be sorting itself out over time within your profession. I don't know. What do you tend to use?
Yeah, Martha, I've been taught kind of what you just described, which is that patients don't always identify with their sex. And so man or woman would be the more appropriate term, depending on whether or not the patient identifies with their sex or not.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense.
All right, next question here. Data. Is it always plural? Is there ever a case when I would say the data is, or is it always the data are?
You know, 10 years ago, 13 years ago, I would have said unequivocally the data are, because I have a background in Greek and Latin, and of course, data is plural. But you know what? It can really go either way. And I hate to be so wishy-washy about this, but the more time I spend looking at language, the more I see the infinite variety here. And again, I think the best thing to do is just be consistent whichever way you're going with it. One book that we like to recommend a lot is Garner's Modern American Usage by the writer Brian Garner, who has a lot of really firm rules for this and that. And also he tracks language change, how data versus data change over the years and what people are doing in terms of usage, because it is changing. I mean, that's the thing about language. It's an organism. It's always changing and evolving. If language didn't evolve, then we'd all be talking like they did in the time of Beowulf. You know, we'd be saying, or something like that. It's been a long time since I've read Beowulf. But my point, and I do have one, is that language is changing all the time. And this is one of those things where you're going to hear different people saying different terms no matter where you are. So I hate to be wishy-washy, but really either is correct.
Got it. These next couple are ones that I should know. I routinely struggle with them. I Google them all the time. And so these are really kind of from my Google search history, things that I'm having to look up all the time. So if you have any tips about how to remember them, that would be great.
Okay.
Okay. Can you explain the difference between which and that? So I have a patient with a deep brain stimulator. He's been developing some side effects. Would I say the patient has been developing some side effects of speech disturbance that I believe are related to his stimulation? Or would I say side effects of speech disturbance, which are related to his stimulation?
Okay. I'm going to say, Jason, that the term that I would go with there is that rather than which, and I'll try to explain it. It's a pretty subtle difference, and a lot of people have problems with this. It's kind of tricky. The difference has to do with what we in the language business refer to as essential clauses, also known as restrictive clauses, or non-essential clauses, also known as non-restrictive clauses. And let me give you an example. Let's say that I own two cars, and one of those cars has four doors, and one of those cars has just two doors. Now, listen to these two sentences and see if you can hear the difference in the way that I talk about one of them. Sentence number one. My car that has four doors needs to be washed. And sentence number two is, my car, which has four doors, needs to be washed. Now, there's a subtle difference there, isn't there? When I say, my car that has four doors needs to be washed, you know that that car is different from the other car I own. So that clause describing my car that has four doors, it's an essential clause. It's a restrictive clause. It restricts the term to that particular car. And in the second example, if I say, my car, which has four doors, needs to be washed, that which has four doors, which is set off by commas, is what we call a non-restrictive clause. That is, it's not really essential to the sentence. It's just sort of like, oh, and by the way, my car has four doors and it needs to be washed. So that's the longer linguistic explanation. But the way that I remember it usually is that if you use the term which in a situation like that, you set it off by commas. You don't do that with the word that. And you'll almost always do it correctly if you do it that way. Which is set off by commas, and that doesn't have commas around it.
Great. And the which would be used for asides or comments that are not necessarily essential to the sentence.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And in the sentence you mentioned, the fact that those side effects are specifically related to his stimulation, that's more connected. It's a more essential statement there.
Got it. All right. Next question. Usually when I'm in clinic and I'm using the word effect, I'm describing an adverse effect or a side effect. And so I'm almost always spelling effect with an E. Do you have a helpful rule for remembering when to spell effect with an A versus with an E? I realize that for our listeners out there, you may be rolling your eyes and saying, how does he not know this? But these are the facts. This is the truth.
Yeah, almost everybody, I'd say, has trouble with this. And sometimes including me. In fact, so many people have trouble with affect and effect that they've started using the word impact instead. But I used to work in a hospital years and years and years ago. I was a nurse's aide, and I know that when somebody was impacted, you know, you went running for the enema bag, right? So you don't want to use the word impact necessarily, but I think I can help you with affect and effect. And the short version is that effect is almost always a noun, like side effect, for example. And affect with A at the beginning is almost always a verb, like how did this affect the patient's recovery? There are, of course, rare exceptions. You know, you might talk about a psychiatric patient who has a flat affect, or you might talk about how are we going to effect change in our workplace or something like that. But the little trick that I made up for myself, just so I could remember, is I think about Nebraska and Virginia. And the reason is that I think of the postal abbreviations for Nebraska and Virginia. They are NE and VA, right? So NE, in my mind, it stands for noun effect, and Virginia, VA, stands for verb affect. So that's how I remember.
That's it. That's the trick I've been looking for.
Oh, good. I made that up myself. I wonder if I can sell that somehow.
That's incredible. You might have just lost your opportunity, but thanks for sharing that knowledge anyway. All right. Next question here. What's the difference between titled and entitled? So if one of my colleagues publishes a paper in a medical journal, do I say the paper is titled such and such or entitled such and such, or does it matter?
It doesn't matter that much, but I always recommend titled simply because it's simpler, it's shorter, and I don't know, to me, entitled sounds a little more grandiose, like you're just gilding the lily or something. I mean, you wouldn't be terribly wrong to say entitled, but why not make it simple and just say titled?
That sounds good to me. And last one here, I might have saved the best for last. When a colleague sends a patient to me in clinic, I'll try to send a letter back to the referring physician. And oftentimes my opening sentence will be along the lines of, as you know, Mr. Such and Such is a 60-year-old man whom you referred for. But is that right? Or should it be who you referred? Do you have a helpful rule for using who versus whom?
Oh, gosh, Jason, a rule. Well,
do you have any state abbreviations that could be helpful in this regard?
State abbreviations. Well, is there one that I'm not coming up with a state abbreviation, but I have to preface this by saying that I used to be such a stickler about who and whom, again, because I have this background in Latin, and it's just so obvious if you've had Latin or you grew up speaking another inflected language like Latin or Greek. But you're correct to say whom you referred. But the problem is that whom, you know, the older I get, the more I feel like a fuddy-duddy saying whom. I mean, it's correct, but the older you get, you're going to have more and more younger colleagues who think you're just using a vestigial organ, Jason. This is, let it go. I mean, you know, these days I fire up Twitter and it says who to follow. And there's some battles that you just got to stop fighting. And that's the thing. It's what we call a skunked word in that, you know, people are going to have strong feelings about it one way or the other, most likely. But I just rearrange the sentence and think of the word him, not to be sexist, but I think of the word him, which changes from he when it's the object of a verb, right? I gave the book to him. He gave the book to me. I just think of the word him, and that helps me if I rearrange the sentence, because if you rearrange it so that it's you referred, is it him or he? You don't say you referred he, you say you referred him. And so I think of the him, and I just have this vestigial who at the front of the of the word, if that makes sense. I mean, the M there, I guess, is the vestigial organ, if that makes sense.
No, that's a great analogy. No, that's very helpful. Thank you. Thank you.
But I think I should have my M removed, frankly. I think it's going to burst.
Terrific. Well, you have exhausted all my questions. I have to pause here and offer my apologies to all of my former English teachers who collectively are hanging their heads that I never learned these rules 15 years ago. But I think they're things that a lot of us struggle with, or at least I'm telling myself that. So thank you for clearing these things up.
Well, you know, you have to take some of those rules with a grain of salt. Calvin Trillin once said, as far as I'm concerned, whom is a word that was invented to make everyone sound like a butler. But, you know, the bottom line here is that as long as you're consistent, you're going to be fine. Don't get too tangled up in grammar. There's a lot more to explore in terms of language.
Terrific. That sounds like a good parting thought. Martha, thank you for your time. I've really enjoyed this. Again, listeners, if you want to listen to Martha, you can tune in to her radio show, Away with Words, found on several NPR affiliates. And also you can download their podcast by the same title, Away with Words. Martha, thank you so much.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Welcome to this week's featured interview. I'm Jeff Ratliff from Jefferson University. In this week's interview, we're welcoming Bonnie Scott from the University of Florida to discuss her paper in this week's issue of Neurology titled Co-occurrence of Apathy and Impulse Control Disorders in Parkinson's Disease. In this study, Bonnie and her colleagues sought to study the relationship between apathy and impulse control disorders as a possible disorder of motivation in Parkinson's disease. Bonnie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So before we start and jump into the study, I want to talk a little bit about these behavioral issues in Parkinson's disease. And I want to start with apathy. I know I personally have struggled with either recognizing apathy and certainly with treating it in the Parkinson's patients that I take care of. I found it hard to distinguish apathy from something like anhedonia that we might see in depression, also common in our Parkinson's patients. Can you help me and our listeners differentiate these a little bit? Is apathy a milder form of depression, or are we talking about separate psychological entities in our Parkinson's patients?
So that's a really good question, and it's a little difficult to disentangle, but let's start with depression. So depression is a mood disorder. So it involves like persistent feelings of sadness. It may include symptoms like pessimism, self-dislike or self-criticalness, maybe crying or feeling worthless. And historically, the diagnosis of depression can include both apathy and anhedonia. But more recently, research has shown that clinically significant symptoms of both apathy and anhedonia can occur independently as a standalone syndrome. Apathy specifically has been identified as one of the major neuropsychiatric signatures of Parkinson's disease. And rather than a mood disorder like depression, apathy is a motivational disorder that's characterized by a reduction in goal-directed behavior. So you essentially don't have the get up and go or the sort of drive that you used to. And manifestations of apathy, they might include like a lack of interest and participation in recreational or other activities that you used to enjoy, might include like difficulty initiating or completing a task and stuff like that. And historically, apathy has been conceptualized as having cognitive, behavioral, and emotional aspects. And now there's a lot of evidence to support the distinction between like the cognitive and behavioral components of apathy. But many researchers really still think that the emotional component is more so synonymous with the concept of anhedonia. Anhedonia can broadly be defined as a lack of pleasure. But here too, we can make further distinctions. So anhedonia has been sort of subdivided into what we now call anticipatory versus consummatory anhedonia. So if you think about it, there's a difference between the pleasure that you feel in anticipation of a reward, and then there's pleasure that you feel when you actually receive the reward, actual reward enjoyment. And that's the hedonic impact. So here we've got wanting versus liking, or at least that's how they conceptualize it in the preclinical animal literature. For an example, the more we enjoy something, the more likely we're going to want it in the future, right? And the more we want something, the greater effort or motivation that we're going to be willing to put into actually obtaining it. And these are the basic stages of reward processing, and they're linked to separate, dissociable, but also overlapping neurobiological mechanisms. And it's not hard to imagine how an issue with one aspect of reward processing could then influence others. So for example, if I suddenly stop liking something, I'm not going to want it as much in the future, right? And then I'll be less motivated or less likely to put in the effort to then pursue it. So in this way, either or both aspects of anhedonia could produce apathy by reducing the motivation to pursue potentially rewarding experiences. And each of these aspects of reward processing, like I said, they have dissociable neurobiological mechanisms, but they do all rely on the integrity of frontostriatal circuitry. And that's exactly what is disrupted in our Parkinson's patients.
And the other behavior that you guys are studying in this study is impulse control disorders, or ICDs, and Parkinson's. And I think we're perhaps a little more familiar with these phenomena, and we have talked about this in prior podcast episodes, but it never hurts to refresh. So what are some key questions that we should be asking in the clinic of our Parkinson's patients or of their families to help screen for and discover impulse control disorders?
Yeah, so impulse control disorders, they involve two different aspects, right? First, you have that impulsivity or the lack of forethought before you act on something. But then you also have the compulsive aspect. And it may be that those impulsive behaviors are what become compulsive over time. So you want to be asking about both. You want to be asking your patients, you know, have you been doing things that you didn't think about beforehand and then maybe had aversive consequences? Or have you found yourself engaging in repetitive activities or doing something over and over despite adverse consequences? I think most importantly, you want to be informing your patients before they even start any sort of dopamine replacement therapy, because ICDs are potentially embarrassing or shameful behaviors that patients might not feel comfortable disclosing. And I think it might make it easier for them if at the time of diagnosis, before they've even started taking any dopaminergic medication, you let them know, hey, this could potentially be a side effect. Be on the lookout for this. And I think it might make it easier for them then to, at a follow-up appointment, say, hey, doc, you're right. I started noticing that I was doing things repetitively or what have you. And, you know, you can educate them about the different types of ICDs. You know, some of the most common ones in Parkinson's disease are hypersexuality, pathological gambling, compulsive eating or spending, so that they know to be on the lookout for those sorts of things.
I think that helps, at least giving them a heads up when you start treatment or even before you start treatment may increase our ability to find these or discover them in our patients down the road. So given what you told us about apathy and its relationship to some of the reward behaviors that we've talked about, and then folding in impulse control disorders, you mentioned in the paper that part of the motivation for this study was to evaluate whether apathy and impulse control disorders are opposite ends of what you term a motivational spectrum, where ICDs would be sort of a pathologic increase in reward-seeking behaviors, and apathy is at the other end with this abnormal deficiency of motivation to seek out reward. Can you tell us a little bit about your study and what you learned about the relationship between these two pathological behaviors?
Yeah, so the idea for this paper actually came out of my dissertation. I was looking at the neurophysiological signatures of motivational disorders in Parkinson's disease. And the predominant conceptualization of these conditions is that they exist as opposite extremes of this dopamine-dependent spectrum of reward and motivation. And so for my dissertation, my hypotheses and aims were all in accordance with that. I'm going to compare these three groups, apathetic, ICD, and neither. And then I started getting patients who screened positive on both our apathy and our ICD measure. And I immediately thought I must be doing something wrong. You know, how can I double check this? Because it was just unheard of. Even to my supervisor and other movement disorder specialists who were supervising and assisting with my dissertation. And so we went in and looked at what's called the INFORM database, which is a longitudinal data set maintained here at the University of Florida, where Parkinson's patients, as well as other movement disorder patients, every time we see them, they get these same measures at every visit. So we went in and looked to see if we could find anyone who had significant scores on both measures. And sure enough, we did. Given how large that data set is, we thought that would be much more informative and relevant in terms of reporting the prevalence of the co-occurrence of these conditions as compared to my small dissertation sample. So that's really what we focused on here. And we found that there was a sizable proportion of these patients who had both significant apathy and impulse control disorders. And this simple discovery really has far-reaching implications. You know, first and foremost, it challenges the spectrum conceptualization of these conditions. And it also highlights the problem of how prevailing theoretical conceptualizations can actually limit the scope of empirical research. because previous investigations have either focused on one or the other. They haven't included both, like in the same study cohort, under this assumption that they're opposites, that they're diagnostically distinct. One concern that this actually raises is that maybe previous research in this area has been based on mixed samples because investigators, for example, maybe focused on apathy, didn't screen for ICDs. I have to emphasize, though, okay, that this was a simple epidemiological study, which by itself, you know, can't tell us more about the relationship between apathy and ICDs other than the fact that they're commonly co-occurring and that their co-occurrence is associated with higher rates of anxiety and depression. But we think that this co-occurrence might be suggestive of shared underlying pathology. And it's really going to be future research that's going to be able to specify more this relationship and what's going on from a neurobiological perspective. So hopefully our findings can stimulate and improve the design of future research into shared neurobiological mechanisms and so forth.
And so it sounds like the results, acknowledging that this is, like you said, an epidemiological study looking at the population there in Florida, but the results do sort of poke holes in that existing framework that these are opposite ends of a single spectrum and that their co-occurrence certainly indicates that whether they are still related in some way or just happen to be co-occurring neurobehavioral aspects of Parkinson's disease, sounds like that's sort of the opportunity to study this next. What about dopamine? We recall learning in medical school, and you've already mentioned this in the interview, about this relationship between reward behavior and dopamine and nucleus accumbens and some of these frontal circuits and pathways. And we know that impulse control disorders are closely tied with the use of dopamine agonists and, to a lesser degree, levodopa and other dopamine therapies. What did the study teach us about the role of either endogenous dopamine or perhaps dopamine agonist medications in modifying or fueling some of the behaviors we're studying here?
Honestly, I don't think this study tells us much more about the relationship between dopaminergic medications and motivational disorders than we already knew. There's a really large body of literature linking ICDs to agonist use, as you said. But there's also accumulating research now that indicates that the occurrence of these conditions really can't be accounted for by dopamine alone. And in our study, we found that patients with ICD only, as well as those with both comorbid apathy and ICDs, were generally on higher doses of agonists than those with apathy. But when we then segmented our groups based on motivational status and depression, for example, this difference wasn't significant anymore. Then there's also the issue of age. We know that striatal dopamine levels can change across the lifespan and potentially influence a patient's response to dopaminergic medications. There's several studies showing that patients with ICDs tend to be younger, while those with apathy tend to be older. But in our study, the patients with both apathy and ICDs were older than those with ICD only, and they also were on significantly higher doses of agonists than those with apathy only. There's also many other factors that have been linked to the development of ICDs, really, like premorbid reward-related personality traits, genetics, et cetera. And that was really beyond the scope of this study. So if anything, I think by highlighting the common co-occurrence of these conditions, we've just added, essentially, an additional layer of complexity to the issue, which, though, is consistent with this growing body of literature indicating that, yes, while dopamine is important, these motivational disorders can't be accounted for by dopamine alone. But again, the identification of this group of patients with comorbid apathy and ICDs that have previously been overlooked in the literature will hopefully improve the design of future research in this area. And this might help clarify some of these issues further.
And just to add even more complexity, we know that ICDs and apathy are not the only behavioral syndromes in Parkinson's disease. And you've already talked about depression, and there's obviously anxiety frequently in our patients with Parkinson's disease as well. So those are two other very common issues that we see. Given what we talked about a few minutes ago about the relationship between maybe depression or anhedonia and apathy, what does the coincidence in this cohort of anxiety or depression or mood disorders teach us about patients developing either apathy or ICDs or both?
I think the co-occurrence of mood and motivational disorders just highlights what we already knew, which is that both mood and motivation are associated with disruptions in reward processing. The question now is really what stages of reward processing are disrupted in the various conditions, which I think research has already started to shed light on, of course. But this more recent trend in research of further specifying terms like anticipatory and consummatory anhedonia, for example, and also examining transdiagnostic features, which has been highlighted by the RDoC project, will really help us to begin to clarify the answers to these issues and help us understand why some people develop different patterns of comorbidity than others.
In our patients who are on dopamine agonists, we may have more vigilance looking for impulse control disorders. In patients who have an established diagnosis of depression or anxiety, does that change our clinical vigilance for impulse control disorders or for apathy, in your opinion?
I think maybe in some cases it does. We might conclude, oh, this person has depression, and then not go on to screen for other conditions. And I think that's really sort of the take-home message of this article is that these are common conditions. They occur together very commonly. And so just because someone has apathy, you know, doesn't mean that they don't have an ICD, or just because someone has depression doesn't mean that they don't have profound apathy. And so really the take-home message is that we need to be screening for all of the above in routine clinical practice.
Great. I think that's really helpful. And thank you again for joining us. For our listeners, I've been speaking with Bonnie Scott, a psychologist from the University of Florida, about her study in this week's issue of Neurology titled Co-occurrence of Apathy and Impulse Control Disorders in Parkinson's. As always, there's a lot more we weren't able to get to, so please go check out her team's paper in this week's issue of Neurology. Thanks, Bonnie.
Thanks.
Don't forget to check out Neurology's three subspecialty journals, Neurology Genetics, Neurology, Neuroimmunology, and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice, as well as our mini-sites on Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, Global Neurology, and Innovations in Care Delivery. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.